All right. Thank you so much, you guys, for tuning in today. This is KJU 770, 880 AM in the UCSB residence halls, and you're listening to your host, Mariah Brennan Clegg, with her show, Powder Clegg. So yeah, thanks so much, you guys. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to start off by doing some headlines. Going to try out a couple new segments on the show, and then we're going to have a very special guest on. We're going to have Robert Bernstein. And he's going to be talking to us today about visions of the future, kind of dovetailing nicely with some of the themes that we've been talking about eco-socialism, about the environmental future. And yeah, that should be really exciting. But first, I want to start off with a new segment of mine called Where'd You Get Your Protein Today? So as I've mentioned before on the show, I'm a vegan. And yeah, everyone just automatically tuned off right when I said that, I know. But a question that I get a lot of times is, you know, where do you get your protein? And you know, it's a fair question. It's one that I get a lot. And it's kind of one that I want to be able to address. So with this segment, I'm going to be talking about how I get my protein. So today, taking a dietary example, I had an awesome breakfast. Today we've got, I made myself a big old bowl of buckwheat. So you make buckwheat, you can make buckwheat in lots of different ways. You can make it into soba noodles. You can make it into, what I do typically is I'll make just like a big old batch of it. Like it's, you kind of prepare it like oatmeal. And then you can either make it sweet or you can make it savory. This morning I added ground up flax seeds. Very important to grind those because your body actually can't like break them down unless they're already kind of ground up, which is kind of interesting. They've actually found like flax seeds like still in people's like digestive tract that have not been like broken down, like in, you know, like bog people, you know, like people bodies they find in bogs. So this stuff is resilient. You know, you kind of need to grind it up in order to for it to be broken down at all. So anyway, you got flaxseed, you got chia seeds, throw in some hemp seeds, and then I toss in some nutritional yeast. Nutritional yeast is a great way to get your B12s if you're a vegan. And then I do Bragg's amino acids, which is basically like a soy sauce alternative. If you don't know about it, get to your local co-op. Co-op sells it like in bulk, basically. The IV co-op, that is. Or you can get it pretty much at any, most grocery stores, definitely all health food stores. So yeah, that's a great way to, you know, kind of add salt to your diet, I know everyone's looking for that, right? But it's, you know, kind of healthy sodium. If you're a New Englander like me, then, you know, you're basically desensitized to any quantity of salt. So you need a ton of that stuff, right? So it's important to get it in a way that's not going to, you know, kill you. But yeah, then you add avocado and you've got a big old meal there that's got lots of protein in it. Really nutritious, really healthy. Great way to start your day. and a great alternative to eating animal protein in the morning. So thus concludes the first segment of How Do You Get Your Protein Today? So thanks so much for listening to that. So now we've got, we're going to do some headlines, but first I just want to make a little announcement. Later on today, very exciting, I'm very nervous about it, but I'll be giving a talk in the McCune Conference Room, which is in, if you're on campus and you're listening in the UCSB residence halls, then you might know where that is. It's in the Humanities and Social Sciences building, all the way on the sixth floor, and I'm going to be giving a talk about artful living, which should be interesting, and kind of artful living as a way towards activism, particularly as it relates to the Paris conference that I've talked about before, but the COP21, the climate protests that are being organized in Paris. I think artful living is going to have a lot to do with that. I was looking at the itinerary of events, basically, for the climate protests in Paris, and I absolutely can't wait. I'm so excited about it. We're going to have basically teams. They're called affinity groups, and we're basically going to be working together in these little teams to try to confront authority, raise our voices, make ourselves heard, and basically create a crisis state in Paris, right? And so we all have team names. And then there's Team Blue. Team Blue is the police. So I think it's really funny to, and really kind of, it's authority challenging, right? In a way to bring the police, you know, kind of down to our level, right? Make them the butt of our joke. I think that's really interesting. Anyway. But yeah, now we're going to, so come to that later on today. It starts at 1:00. It'll go probably until 3:00. There might be food. I can't make any promises. But yeah, so if you're not doing anything today, Tuesday, from 1 to 3, then stop by the Mikun Conference Center, and watch me make a fool of myself in front of all of the professors who I hope to work with in the coming years when I apply for grad school. Yay! but yeah, so let's get into headlines, you guys. So there was, as I was trying to put together a show for today, I came across a lot of stories, obviously, that are really important. Lots of news with climate change. We've got Hurricane Patricia, which hit Mexico, which does not look like it was quite as bad as we thought it was going to be. Not necessarily like a Katrina kind of style storm, but it was the largest hurricane that has ever been kind of recorded in the Western Hemisphere. And Democracy Now! Reports this morning, the remnants of Hurricane Patricia have moved east after drenching parts of Texas with more than a foot of rain. The strongest hurricane ever recorded, Patricia made landfall Friday evening on Mexico's Pacific coast, uprooting trees and power lines and setting off mudslides with winds of 165 miles per hour. But the damage was blunted by mountainous terrain, and Patricia was quickly downgraded. Despite fears of mass casualties, there have been no confirmed fatalities from the storm in Mexico. Scientists have warned stronger hurricanes like Patricia will result from climate change. And I think this is really important because what I really like about this reporting is that it doesn't go so far as to say like, oh well, you know, Hurricane Patricia wasn't that big a deal, we're fine, climate change is fake, right? Because I think that's a lot of people's tendencies when they look at storms and they don't necessarily measure up to, you know, kind of what we thought they were going to be. Well, they think that we can just kind of dust our hands off and walk away. And while it's amazingly good news that Hurricane Patricia, which was not as horrible as we thought it was going to be, it's still important to look at it kind of in the broader context, look at it as part of climate change, and know that we're going to get harsher and harsher storms as climate change escalates. Next, we've got news from Israel. This is another reporting saying that violence is continuing in Israel and the occupied territories. Earlier today, Israeli forces shot and killed a teenage Palestinian accused of stabbing an Israeli in Hebron. A day earlier, Israeli border police shot and killed a 17-year-old girl at the border checkpoint. Police said the girl approached officers with a knife, but a witness told CNN that the accused assailant was a terrified schoolgirl who raised her arms, saying, "I don't have a knife." Close to 60 Palestinians have now been killed by Israeli security forces this month, about 30 of whom were accused of attacking Israelis. 10 Israelis have been killed in Palestinian attacks. So clearly we see here a lot of both micro and macro aggressions that are being carried out by Israel against Palestinians. And we see this pretty consistently with Israel, and an entirely disproportionate response to Palestinian uprising. And in Israel, they actually have a term for this. This is mowing the lawn, right? So basically the idea is that as soon as Palestine starts to raise their voices, whether that's, you know, democratically, whether that's politically, or whether that's violently, there is always a response on the part of Israel to cut that down, right? And in doing so, disempower the Palestinian people. So I think this is a really important narrative to follow. But I also wanted to talk a little bit in perhaps a little bit more of a lighthearted sense about some news from the land of corporate absurdity, I suppose. So first of all, this was a report from Burlington, Vermont. Vandals burn, decapitate, cut feet off Ronald McDonald. And I just had to read this article as soon as I saw it. This is from Burlington, Vermont, NECN, which is their news show, a local news show. On three separate nights this month, vandals irreparably damaged the smiling Ronald McDonald statue that sat outside the Ronald McDonald House in Burlington, Vermont. "Isn't this sad?" said Christine Bickford, the house's executive director, as she showed the ruined fiberglass body of the famous clown. For years, Ronald occupied a bench outside the home, providing a comforting welcome to children and their families who need to be close to the University of Vermont Medical Center for vital care. Bickford said vandals first burned Ronald's face, then took off his head, and next cut his feet off with a saw. "The head was discovered, dumped near the city's waterfront," Bickford said. "The kids were traumatized," Bickford said, noting volunteers had to move the remains of the statue into storage. Okay, so a couple things about this. For one thing, I can't help but think that this is a really hilarious act of vandalism. I can't get all that worked up about defacing a fiberglass Ronald McDonald sculpture. It seems like of all the things that we need to be upset about in this world, defacing a corporate mascot doesn't seem like the top of our priority list. At the same time, this Ronald McDonald statue is sitting outside a Ronald McDonald House. The Ronald McDonald houses, if you're not familiar, they're basically places where low-income people who need to receive, whose children need to receive medical care, can be put up in these houses. And it serves as a cheap place for them to live, basically, while their children get care. And this is a really important service. It is not a service that we should have to rely on Ronald McDonald to supply. This is something that we should be doing as a society because it's the right thing to do. We shouldn't be relying on corporate charity. At the same time, in absence of a real social structure that says it's important for people to have housing, right? Because, I mean, honestly, this shouldn't be just a thing for kids who are sick and their families. It should be a thing for everyone. If you're low income, you should have a safe place to live. That should be a human right, right? In absence of that, it is, I guess, good that the Ronald McDonald House exists. I think that McDonald's plays a big role in keeping people poor, in not wanting to pay people a fair wage, right? As we all know, big corporations like Walmart, like McDonald's, are the biggest welfare queens ever, right? They're getting, they basically don't have to pay their workers higher wages because the state is, kind of picking up the slack through welfare programs. So Ronald McDonald and, that whole institution really is creating a lot of poverty, the kind of poverty that puts people in the position such that they need Ronald McDonald housing. So in conclusion, while it's definitely sad that children in Burlington, Vermont, the people who are staying at the Ronald McDonald House, had to see their beloved clown defaced, I just can't get all that worked up about it. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with special guest Robert Bernstein. Thank you guys so much.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning again. He's in the bathtub with a line of cocaine. He checks the cell phone to cool down his brain. Checks the mirror, his hair has gone gray. Wants to walk the rest of himself down the drain. Wash himself down the backseat in the backseat. seat with a bottle of gin. To the office and now the airport again. He moves quickly and smiles at the man. Act sharp now, eye contact, shakes hands, he moves like a man moves, and he thinks like a man should. He knows that he's got a nice home, and he's told all these roads lead to Rome. Oh,
for tuning back in, you guys. You're listening to KJU 770-880 AM, broadcasting in the UCSB residence halls. This is Mariah Brennan-Clegg, your host for Powder Clegg. And the song that you were just listening to is called Nobody's a Long Time, and that's by Noah Harley and the Horse-Eyed Men from their album Grave Country. And we're back right now with our very special guest, Robert Bernstein. So welcome, welcome, Robert. How have you been?
Oh, doing great. Glad to be on the program.
Good, good. So yeah, we're pretty much what we wanted to talk about today was visions of the future. As we talk about a lot on this show, we're headed towards environmental calamity, and you know, so what do we do to confront this, and what do our visions of the future look like? And I think while it's important, I think to do the next right thing and to focus on confronting power that exists, we do need to have an eye towards what we want the future to look like. And it was kind of during one of these conversations that Robert and I started to clash on one of these issues. So I think we're just going to start there. In particular, we were talking about the Pope's visit, which happened several weeks ago, as you guys probably remember. But we were kind of being a little critical of the Pope, being critical of you know how people have kind of started have just kind of wholeheartedly embraced him and everything he's got to say. And Robert brought up a really interesting point, so I think I'll just I'll let you launch off with that.
Well, yeah, the Pope was talking about climate change, and it was interesting to watch his speech to Congress because, as the corporate media said, well, he had something for everybody, which basically meant that the climate change deniers, they just tuned in on the fact that he was still anti-gay and anti-women, and so they were just like, great, he's our guy. And the liberals sort of said, oh, he talked about climate change. So basically nobody's position changed. But but right at about the same time, I read this article in The Nation magazine by Katha Pollitt, who's famous feminist author in The Nation magazine, oldest magazine in the U.S., and she was commenting that the Pope, for all of his rhetoric about climate change, he in one motion could do something that would eliminate somewhere between a quarter and a third of greenhouse gases, and that was to lift his ban on contraception. And so I commented on this to Mariah, and then the sport
and all hell broke loose. No. but I think it's a really it's a really important point that you brought up. So I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about population and to what extent that's tied to climate change. So in my understanding, it's really not the explosion of population that has put us in this, you know, in this environmental calamity. The places where we're seeing the largest population growth are places in the third world, where people really aren't consuming a whole, you know, more than their fair share of resources. The issue seems to be more, in my mind, that that we're people in kind of the first world and the global north are consuming way, way, way more than they should. And these are the same places that we're seeing kind of birth rates kind of stabilizing. So my concern is that by talking about population so much, we're kind of placing the blame that I think should lie on, you know, and, you know, not to beat up on you or anything, but that white men in the global north have created, you know, these problems that people in the global north have created, kind of shifting that blame to the third world womb, which is, I think, kind of problematic. I guess so. How would you respond to that kind of criticism about population? Because I know that you've got arguments.
Well, I mean, I could argue your side, and I have many times in the past. And I would basically, the bottom line is going to be they're both true. White men have created all these inventions that burn lots of fuel. On the other hand, we're all pretty grateful for a lot of those inventions. And I've spent a lot of time traveling in the third world. And the thing that I always notice is that the worst things that I hate about American culture are the things that they adopt first. And so if when I was a child, we lived in a civilized country where bicycles and public transit were the primary transportation form.
Whoa, wait a minute. Civilized countries. Wait, I thought progress was defined by everyone having a car.
So what's interesting is that in that country, almost everybody did own a car, but that was sort of for your weekend getaway. But real transportation was always about public transit and bicycles. And there's, when you're in a civilized country, everybody has money and resources, so there's no status to showing off that you've got a car. Everybody's got one in their garage. But if you go to a poor country, the first thing they want is a car. And if they can't have a car, they want a motorbike, preferably a really noisy one that really shows off their status.
That's so funny. You know I ride a motorcycle, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. But in any
don't worry
event,
about it.
But in any event, it's only when a country gets to a certain higher level where they can, in fact, say, no, we don't need that stuff. So one of the points, of course, that Katha Pollitt made in her Nation article was that you take a country like the Philippines that's almost 100% Catholic, and you have a huge population there that wants birth control, and the Pope is blocking the government programs to do this. So this is not forcing anything on these women. But eventually, I don't know how much time we have, but at some point I want to get to this vision thing. And so I was just, at some point, I'd like to hear your vision of the future so that I know where we're at.
Yeah, no. I gotta wish I knew where I was at as well. To be perfectly honest, it's something that I've been thinking about a lot recently because I have started to realize more and more that I think, and this is I think a fair criticism of lots of people on the left, that there's an emphasis on trying to confront systems, right, and tear down, but not a whole lot of interest in hammering out the specifics of what we actually want that future to look like, not in any kind of serious way, at least. But I do take your point, and I do think it's about kind of third world countries, or what we might call developing countries. Calling them developing, I think, depends on a lot on how we define development, right? But I do take your point that as kind of American culture starts to spread, and at least like some, even though we see great inequality blossoming really in pretty much every country that that globalization touches, whenever another nation or another society gets the resources to become bad consumers, they leap on that. And I think a lot of that is structural. I think a lot of it has to do with the kinds of powers that get set up in these new countries. I think a lot of it has to do with the inability to pursue sustainable development, though I think we might even call into question those terms. We really haven't provided a good path for, and I think this is the duty of the Global North. I think it's our duty to help create ways for the rest of the world to come, to advance and to, but without having to rely on fossil fuels, and also to do so in a way that basically allows for equality rather than inequality to blossom. I think it's a fair point about trying to make sure as more countries get more resources, that they don't use those resources in the same ways that the Global North has.
Well, I'd like to leap directly into my vision, and then we'll see whether we have even more clashes or whether we have agreement.
All right, sounds good.
So I have a couple of different visions. Ever since I was a child, I was fascinated with sort of utopian societies, and. So back in the 60s, when I was a kid, I wasn't old enough to stay up for this, so I had to watch the reruns on Star Trek. But Star Trek in the 60s was, to me, the ideal vision of the future, where you have this high technology. It's not used to exploit people. It's used to empower people. You never really see too much of what it's like back on Earth, which is deliberate. There's mm-hmm. indirect references to the fact that things like racism and poverty are something of the distant past that you have to dust off a very old history book to read about. And the resources instead are used for exploration and enrichment, and not just scientific enrichment, but cultural, artistic, and so on, enrichment. And back on Earth, the idea is that people aren't driving around in big cars or anything. Mm-hmm. We have no idea what sort of vehicles they have, if any, but the mm-hmm. idea is that you could imagine that back on Earth, everything has been allowed to become quite green, and people are probably mostly walking places, and you certainly would not have big areas of pavement for whatever kind of vehicles they had. But the idea is that there is this technology, mm-hmm. and one of the benefits of that technology is a variant of what I was talking about that you see in civilized countries, which is that when you have a certain level of resources, then you don't expend resources just for status, because everybody has access to those resources. In fact, acquisition of things is just a burden. Mm-hmm. You try to acquire as little as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. And I think that's I think that's a really beautiful vision of the future. My problem, I guess, is that I don't know how we get there. I don't see a path from here to there. I don't see how we even continue to extract resources while not burdening people with the labor of extraction. I don't see, for example, like even how we create more energy with solar panels. You know, solar panels. You know, I'm totally in favor of renewables, and I think we should we need to put a lot of resources into developing them. At the same time, I think we got to recognize that somebody is going to be mining the minerals that we need to create the solar panels, and those people are not going to belong to the same cohort as the people who are deciding that we need solar panels, right? It's going to be the same.
Well, it's interesting because in Star Trek, they still do have miners, and they are the most highly paid people, and they have women after them. Sorry, they're guys. The miners are guys.
Okay, all right, but we've still got at least some of the old forms of oppression.
No. The idea is that I don't know. One thing about Star Trek, of course, was that every episode was written by somebody else, and there were in fact contradictions among different episodes. But that was something came up in a couple of episodes. I think the idea is that you could have it that you're so highly paid that maybe you do that for a couple of years in your life and then you have this life of leisure. Some people also may enjoy those kinds of jobs. There are other utopian visions, by the way, and I want to get to some of those. So there's a famous one called Walden 2. I don't know if you're familiar with Walden 2.
I'm not. I know of the Venus Project, but that's honestly the only real utopian kind of future that I've studied at any kind of scrutiny.
Well,
but Walden 2, yeah.
Walden 2 was written right after World War II, but if you read it, you would think it was just written yesterday, and it was written by a psychologist who I won't name, you can look that up, who basically designed a utopian society based on psychological principles of the day, many of which are still quite valid. And the idea was that by definition, if there was something that was not pleasant to do, then you just had to pay people enough to do it. This is the argument about picking fruit and Mexican immigrants and so on, is that, well, nobody in America will do this work. And it's like, well, nobody will do the work for that pay. Mm-hmm. So maybe you need to either change the nature of that work or you need to pay people more for that work.
Right. And I mean, I think that's an important part because, you know, you talk about, you know, people, you know, okay, pay me enough and I'll mine for coal. We do a kind of similar thing or mine for, or not even coal, because if we're not talking about fossil fuels, but, you know, they'll mine for minerals or whatever. We kind of have these ideas about paying people lots of money to work in kind of the oil industry, right? You know, you get these like oil camps basically that's set up, and it's basically, you know, people, you know, kind of young, unattached men typically go and work in these work at, you know, oil refineries or oil processing or, you know, or oil extraction, and their plan is to, you know, get in, get out, make a lot of money and leave. But they don't end up doing that, and I'm wondering why you think that is, and why you think that will change. That would change in the future, or with different industries.
Honestly, I'm going to make another leap in another direction.
Oh, please do.
Okay, so are you familiar with Ray Kurzweil?
No.
Okay, so Ray Kurzweil has an idea that he promotes, and I must say that he did not invent this idea, but he calls it the singularity. Have you heard of the singularity?
Mm-mm.
No. Okay. So you will now. You'll hear it everywhere. So,
and all of our viewers will too.
Yeah, I'm sure they probably, a lot of them have. So
listeners, they're not viewers.
So the idea is, so I come from the world of science and technology, and there's a principle called Moore's Law. Moore was one of the founders of Intel Corporations. And back in the late 60s, early 70s, he noticed that microprocessor power, well, there were no microprocessors, I'm sorry, information processing power was doubling every year or two. And not and information processing power in memory was increasing at this rate. This was in the very early days of integrated circuits. And so if you project that forward, when you have, that's called exponential growth. And so if you project that forward, you get a very, very steep increase in growth. And that's what we've seen in my lifetime is that now, you know, you have in your pocket a computer that's more powerful than what put the men on the moon, and way more powerful. So the but if you project that forward a little bit further, you get something in your pocket that's as smart as you are, and if you go a little bit further, you get something that we don't have any idea what that is. And that would be something that's smarter than we are, which by definition we can't even grasp, right? So that changes everything. It changes everything, not just about resources, but it also changes everything about what our role is in the world, in the universe, whatever. At first, we have the situation we have now. We make technology and the technology serves us. Although when you watch people walking down the streets addicted to their phone, you sort of wonder who's in charge. But there does get to be kind of a synthesis. And Kurzweil's vision is a positive vision. He manages to spin this in a positive way. Obviously, there's a million ways you could make this dystopian. If you have things that are smarter than us, then they're going to find us kind of an annoyance and they're going to try to get rid of us.
Right. Which honestly, I think is the least of our problems. I think, I don't know, so human extinction doesn't bother me too much. But
Well, you know, it's funny. I say that a lot, too. I mean, in my position as a local Sierra Club board member, you know, I think about the natural ecosystems and man's impact. I could really offend almost all of your listeners by pointing out that one of man's biggest impacts in the natural areas is not his motorized inventions, but it's his biological inventions, namely the man-made carnivores that he sets loose on the local trails.
Right, absolutely. Dogs on trails is a huge detriment to the local ecosystems, right? Because they, for one thing, they scare off local wildlife, and then also their excrement is hugely damaging to ecosystems as well. But don't worry, I've already offended everyone on my show by saying that I'm a vegan. So
good. So we've
no one,
past
no,
that
yeah, no
already.
One's listening anymore anyway.
but I mean, in my mind. Oh yeah, this would be great if people disappeared, then everything would just sort of become natural and wonderful and all this kind of thing. But I'd like to propose another leap. And some of these leaps, you know, I'm not sure that I want to make, but I'm certainly
totally
interested in entertaining. So I am by philosophy a humanist, which means I don't believe in any sky gods or anything like that. And that, you know, it's up to humans to make the world a better place. But in Star Trek, they go beyond that. They go to other planets, and obviously there's not humans on the other planets. There are people on the other planets, but they're not humans. They're other sentient beings. So obviously we have to have something which people now call transhumanism, which is to transcend humanism, which is, when you think about it, is kind of a parochial idea that, that human beings, Homo sapiens, is sort of the be-all, end-all. But that doesn't just mean beings on other planets. It may be that there are no other beings on other planets. Okay, the idea is that we may be synthesizing new forms of intelligence here on Earth. And it's not a them versus us. That's a very important point that Kurzweil makes, is that it's not that we are making robots or something that are going to take over. In fact, they're not necessarily even robots, because it may be biological things. It may be that we change our genetic code in an intelligent way or something.
Yeah,
oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, no, no. Great. I really like this idea of transhumanism. And I think to be perfectly honest, I'm not like I'm not super well versed on Star Trek type stuff. But what I do really like about sci-fi is that it holds a mirror up to us that we can actually stand looking at. You know, in the sense that that we can, you know, by through the sci-fi genre, people can put forth ideas that would be absurd to us in any other kind of genre. And I think what's really cool about this idea of transhumanism that kind of comes out of this, like, you know, kind of which almost like seems like the realm of science fiction. We have that on Earth anyway. We have that, and we should be embracing it on this plane anyway. Even, I would argue, without the introduction of, you know, or the development of new technologies, I think transhumanism could mean something like respecting other species in ways that we don't currently, and recognizing that even though we aren't humans aren't the same as other species, even though, you know, just like there are differences among different groups of peoples, in the Star Trek universe, there are different kinds of intelligences on our planet, and I think we'll be headed in the right direction if we start to realize and respect the intelligences and the feelings and the other beings that we share this Earth with now.
Yeah, one of the reasons why we try to protect the planet is because we don't even know what it is that we're losing, and we're losing
stuff
before we even know what we got. But you know, I'll make another leap. That probably could offend a lot of people, but so in the early days of the planet, you know, there were these single-celled organisms that thrived on what was then the atmosphere, what we would find very toxic, and they put out a product that they found toxic, which was oxygen. And eventually, they kind of choked themselves to death on this oxygen.
So we're not the first ones to mess everything up.
No, but on the other hand, I hope that you get the positive lesson in that, which was that they paved the way for all the life that we now hold dear. Mm-hmm. So the idea is what was a pollutant for them actually was the start of much more interesting life that came later. Mm-hmm. And so... So there is always the possibility that even though you're doing something that's sort of messing stuff up, that in fact it could be the start of something that's really wonderful. And the planet has had a number of mass extinctions where almost all the species were wiped out. And so as far as like what's natural and what isn't, you know, we have to be careful about what that means.
Right.
But I do want to come back to this thing that there may be no other life out there, at least in our galaxy. We don't we have no way to detect life outside of our galaxy. But our galaxy was all that was explored in Star Trek, and the galaxy is really big. And the thing is that we do not detect any signals that in any way seem to show any intelligence in the galaxy. And if you look at the numbers, that's pretty extraordinary. There's a famous Drake equation that gives some estimate, this is decades old, it basically shows that we should be being inundated by signals from other intelligent life, and we're not seeing that. And one possibility is that intelligent life isn't happening. Another is that it wipes itself out.
Right. I've heard that idea.
But another possibility is that, in fact, there's dimensions of reality that we don't know, and it may be that if you get to a certain level of intelligence, maybe you move into those other dimensions of reality. So
I heard that as well,
that's
getting
pretty far afield. But but back to this vision thing, it is kind of important to have some kind of a positive vision and to say that, well, that's the least of our problems, is to worry about this. Actually, in a way, that's... I think it's probably the most important thing. I'll give you, this is not directly relevant, but it's kind of an analogy. You know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysics guy, well, he spends a lot of his time promoting science education. And I saw a talk that he gave where he said, so people always assume that my top priority would be more funding for science education. Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson grew up very poor, black, in New York City. And he said, well, actually, that's not my top priority. He said the thing that got him into a science career was not better teachers. It was the fact that when he was a child, the space program was going on. The real space program, not just putting things a few miles above the planet, but going to the moon and with plans to do more. And he said he just knew that he wanted to be part of that. And he would just go to the New York Public Library and he would read. And so he said that the most important thing for society is to have a big collective positive vision. And so now we have a political problem because the right doesn't want anything with the word collective in it. They hate taxing, spending, investing, whatever. And the left seems to be very good at finding things that are wrong and the dystopian futures and why this is going to mess everything up. And so we really do need another path. I mean, I'll put a notice in here that look, I'm a huge Bernie Sanders supporter. I think that we totally need Bernie Sanders right now. But I think beyond that, we need somebody in the future who has a really big positive vision. Bernie Sanders wants to do all the no-brainer stuff that the U.S. should have done 60 years ago to be a civilized country. Things like true universal health care, free college education, good public transit. I mean, all of as I say, the no-brainer stuff that you need for civilization. But beyond that, we need something really big.
Right. And I think what concerns me, and I definitely get your point, I think we do need a vision of the future. I'm tripped up about this story about Neil deGrasse Tyson, though, because I think it kind of it doesn't seem like a complete solution. I think we obviously need people to be dreaming about about the future. We need inspiration. It almost assumes that we live in a kind of meritocratic state where people with vision can pursue their dreams. And I'm not sure that we have that. And I think we need to construct that first. And that's kind of what concerns me about, visions of the future where, everyone is kind of equal and has a certain standard of living. We need to make some big leaps in terms of deconstructing capitalism, in terms of deconstructing the state. I think that it's quite possible that people, who do enjoy, equality, and I think this is very true, people who enjoy equality in the global north and ride bicycles and walk and have cars but don't really use them, all of that all their lifestyle and all of that technology and all that kind of development that they've experienced over the past decades comes because they are exploiting the global south. There is somebody who we've rendered invisible who's creating the possibility for something like equality in the global north. I think we need to start. I think we need to confront those big problems, and not simply kind of dream up this future. We need to figure out how we're going to get there. So in terms of how I kind of see our future, I do tend to have a little bit more of a short term view, and I think this is probably could be a flaw with my leftism, but I think we need to start thinking about how we're going to confront capitalism and confront extraction and confront all of these oppressive structures. I think, for example, Blockadia is a really powerful movement. People putting their bodies in front of excavators, big coal excavators. I'm not sure if you are you familiar with Ende Gelände at all? Okay, it was this great movement that happened back in August. It happened in Rhineland, and they basically put themselves in front of the coal excavators in Europe's largest coal mine, and they talked a lot about how this is a movement that is directly anti-capitalist, directly anti-extractivist, that is you know, pro equality and direct democracy and all of that. But it's also within that, you also see the creation of a new kind of society being formed, namely these kind of affinity groups that are put that arise out of people working together. And I think in that, we can start to see a seed of the future. And I think by acting imminently, we can go a long way towards creating the future that we want without kind of thinking in, you know, in terms of utopia. I don't know.
Well, I was part of affinity groups and stuff 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I could make those cases, but I'm going to say something in defense, not of capitalism, mm-hmm. but of free markets, mm-hmm. which we do not have. Okay, so one of the reasons why we have unsustainable extraction and automobiles as our dominant non-functional transportation in the U.S. is not because of the free market. It's because we don't have a free market. Mm-hmm. So there's $1 trillion a year in mm-hmm. subsidies for private right. motor vehicle use, okay? And you can go to our Sierra Club website. It's called America's Autos on Welfare. And I really recommend that everybody go there. It's just one page. And in fact, with private motor vehicle use, the biggest externality is not the fossil fuels. When I was first on the Sierra Club board, I was invited to speak to a fourth grade class. You don't go and lecture fourth graders. So I had a bunch of questions, and one of the questions was, suppose you had a car that ran on an unlimited free source of energy, created no pollution, what would still be the environmental impact of such a car? So it doesn't burn fossil fuels, doesn't pollute. What's still the environmental impact? Well, I've tried that with adults and teens, and they fail. They just draw a blank. Mm-hmm. Fourth graders, their hands shot up in the air. And this one boy said, well, you'd still have to cut down all the trees and pave everything over for roads. So they totally got it.
Mm-hmm.
So the other, another externality that we were talking about was the exploitation of the workers. This mm-hmm. idea that the only way that we have our lifestyle is by exploiting people in other countries. Well, again, if you consider fairness an externality mm-hmm. Or unfairness an externality, mm-hmm. then you can charge for that as well. Mm-hmm. And one of the ideas of these visionary ideas of the future is that we don't have to exploit people in other countries in order to have our standard of living. That was really largely done just for extra profits for these corporations. It's like the offshoring of all of our jobs now. Mm-hmm. There was no need to do that. That just increased the profits. The biggest cost of manufacturing is not the whether you're paying somebody $50 an hour, whether you're paying 50 cents an hour. The biggest cost of manufacturing now is the infrastructure of the manufacturing, or what you call the means of production. It's the mm-hmm. it's the equipment. And in fact, an awful lot of manufacturing was pulled back from some poorer countries when they realized that somebody making 50 cents an hour could break something, and it would cost you an awful lot more than if you just paid them a fair wage. So, but again, I want to distinguish between markets and capitalism. Markets are a good thing, in my view. Markets mean that you are charging the true cost of things, and you're allowing those costs to compete. Capitalism is this very strange idea that somehow money is worth more than labor. The idea that somehow or another that you should mm-hmm. value the person who stashes money away over the person mm-hmm. who's doing the actual productive work.
Right.
And one of the symptoms of that is that a substantial fraction of the U.S. economy now is what's called the financial sector. The financial sector is not a productive sector. Production, by definition, means that you're either making something or you're providing a service, a valuable service that people want. Nobody wants to deal with finance. People want the end product.
I mean, I see what you're saying. I'm not sure that I agree that I would argue that the state that we're in today, where fossil fuel industries are being subsidized by the government, where we have this huge financialization of the economy, I don't see how that's not just the logical conclusion of capitalism. And more than anything, I'm not sure that even if we could create a future with capitalism, why we would want to, I suppose.
Well, sorry, you got it backwards.
Okay.
I'm saying that I don't see any value in capitalism.
Uh-huh.
I see a value in markets.
Right. Okay.
Thing, which is that there's a concept that's sometimes called social capital, which is the idea that if you invent something, you didn't invent that thing out of thin air. You invented it because there's an entire infrastructure of the society that you live in, which consists of the public infrastructure and all the other things that people invented before. And so as a result, it's not really fair that you should reap all of the profits of that personally. In
mm-hmm.
fact, the case has been made that a certain percentage of that should go back to society as a whole. So there's nothing about even what we might call capitalism that says that money should go back to an individual rather than to society. But this idea that we only have resources because we're exploiting other people, I think that there's a history that has been done, but there's nothing
mm-hmm.
necessary about it. In fact, there's a bigger concern, which is that places that are really suffering are not places that have been exploited. They're actually places that have been completely outside of the economy. I mean, when I was a child, the saying was a cheap Japanese imitation, because the cheapest thing that you could get was something made in Japan. Well,
mm-hmm.
that nobody even understands what that means anymore, because Japan
mm-hmm.
now is one of the wealthiest countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that countries go from being exploited cheap sources of labor to top producers and wealthy countries very quickly. It's the places like in Africa that are out of the economy completely. Those are the ones that really suffer. The real problem is, do we have enough resources to provide
mm-hmm.
an adequate standard of living for everybody? And some of that, again, if you just deal with it in terms of true markets, where you're charging the true cost for things, then by definition, it has to be sustainable, because if not, then you're not paying the true cost.
But don't you think there's a part of markets that requires kind of constant growth, and that might
no,
be
markets
impossible
don't require,
on a finite planet?
No, markets don't require growth.
Okay. I feel like there's something that I'm not quite understanding.
Well, the thing is that we don't have infinite knowledge. I mean, the thing
mm-hmm.
is that we don't always know the externalities. I mean, you know, maybe 100 years ago, people didn't fully realize what it meant to dump carbon into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But we certainly have for about 40 years now. So the problem wasn't ignorance. The problem was that we simply weren't including that in the economic equation.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, cool. This has been really really interesting talking to you. But I wanted to ask if there's anything else that you'd like to say, Robert, to wrap up this interview.
Yeah, just back to the idea of vision. That I think it's important that everybody really take the time to think about what is their vision of the future, a positive
mm-hmm.
vision of the future, and make it as big a dream as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I like that. Well, thank you so much, Robert, and thank you, listeners, for tuning into KJU 778-80 AM in the UCSB residence halls. This is Mariah Brennan Clegg with Powder Clegg. Stay tuned and listen again next week. Thanks so much, you guys.